Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Jackie M. from the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum about a talk that she's giving tonight about the Japanese influence in European art. And we'll be speaking with Catherine Geyer about hunger in our senior citizens here in Santa Fe. I'm very happy now to welcome Rabbi Ken Chasen. He is the rabbi of Leo Beck Temple in Los Angeles, and he is visiting Santa Fe, and he'll be here tonight at Temple Beth Shalom from 7 to 9, talking about some faith community initiatives to address the problems associated with homelessness. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mary.
So what motivated you to take on the issue of homelessness in Los Angeles, which I gather is a fairly big problem?
Oh, it's a massive problem, and our congregation has, over the course of many years, been involved in a wide range of projects dealing with homelessness. The one that we're engaged in right now and that we'll be discussing tonight really enables individual faith communities to work collectively to end the scourge of family homelessness, really one family at a time, to make a personal connection. And I think for that reason, it's been especially compelling to members of our community.
What was the first step you took in doing this?
Well, we aligned ourselves with an organization called Imagine LA, which seeks to connect communities of faith, churches, mosques, synagogues, with a particular family, and to then provide, over the course of a couple of years' time, all of the resources necessary, not only to help them get off the streets and into housing, but to transcend all of the challenges that oftentimes create the cycle of homelessness, where a family really can't seem to transcend the difficulties and end up once again facing the same set of challenges that left them without a home in the first place. So whether that has to do with providing them with help in balancing a checkbook, or help in procuring work and keeping work, preparing a resume, learning to drive, whatever it may be, it enabled the first step we did really was to connect with this organization, which had some expertise about how to divide up the various responsibilities. And then, of course, our job was to find the volunteers for these various tasks.
So finding the volunteers for things like this, I mean, what it sounds like, you know, helping somebody learn to balance a checkbook, things like that, that's the kind of thing that if you don't learn at home, it's kind of tricky, because you can't go to a social services agency to ask for something that seemingly mundane. It's actually something that you need a friend or mentor to help you do.
Exactly right. The idea is to establish a mentoring relationship between the volunteer members of a congregation that get involved in this project and the family in question. The family that we've been working with at Leo Beck Temple is actually coming close now toward the end of this cycle that we've been working together. And I think they have a sense of, a feeling of home here with us. They're not a Jewish family, but the synagogue happens to be their home base when it comes to these kinds of mentoring. You're right, a mentoring relationship, these kinds of skills that one would acquire from family or friend more so than from an agency.
So how did the people in your congregation feel about getting involved in what sounds like a pretty committed relationship with a family of strangers and a homeless family of strangers?
Yeah, we had some anxiety entering into the project about whether or not we would be able to generate the volunteers. The issue of being connected to strangers and to homeless strangers at that was less of a concern to us. It's been an ongoing commitment within our congregation to work to chip away at the problem of homelessness. And in Los Angeles, there are some particular challenges. It's not an easy task. Large numbers of homeless families and great need. For us, though, our concern was, you're right, it is a sustained relationship. And so the question of, would people be able to kind of commit to getting on the bus and staying on that bus with someone who they didn't already have a longstanding personal tie to. We found with much joy that there was great enthusiasm about doing it, and the key also was about dividing up these different kinds of roles so that it wasn't too onerous a task for any one member or congregant or family, but they had an opportunity to see through the development of a particular life skill or whatever sort of support that they were providing to that family.
How long have you been doing it?
We started almost 2 years ago with this family. The idea is that roughly 2 years' time is kind of the time arc that Imagine LA shoots to establish between the congregation and the homeless family. The idea being that bit by bit, hopefully they're acquiring the life skills and the confidence to apply all those things and those experiences that have been created over the course of that couple of years and to turn it into an ongoing life of stability.
How do you support the family that's mentoring the other family?
Generally the way it works is Imagine LA helps the congregation to understand how to go about dividing this up and then ultimately provides support and ongoing resource for the congregation and to those individual volunteers. The volunteers are not sort of working on their own. It's not as though they decide on their own how to go about continuing to track things going forward. They are always in working collaboratively with the whole group of volunteers. There's a group of about, I'd say, anywhere, depending upon the congregation involved in this work, anywhere between 20 to 30 volunteers doing something in the mix. And not all of them have direct contact with the family. Some are involved in helping to procure housing because they are developers or they have relationships with the city that might help in terms of identifying either transitional or low-income permanent housing. Others are, you know, as we talked about, the checkbook or driving or whatever it may be, may have a personal hands-on relationship. And so it's all really created to be part of a larger whole, and the chairs of this group on the volunteer end in the congregation are tracking all of these various tasks, and the organization Imagine LA continues to provide support as we move forward with all of it.
We're talking to Rabbi Ken Chasen from the Leo Beck Temple in Los Angeles. So there are many well-known issues having to do with living in a society with an insufficient safety net and what happens during an economic downturn, but then it seems like what you're addressing, at least an aspect of what you're addressing, are the psychological problems that arise from instability and long-term economic hardship. What does this actually look like in the families that you've met?
Yeah, it's a really important aspect of this work. So much of what's necessary to transcend the cycle of homelessness in a family's life has to do with one's belief in oneself, one's appreciation that they have the skills and the ambition and the whatever, the connections, the drive necessary to leave that cycle behind. And so we find that the two tend to go hand in hand. As they acquire skills and as they're receiving the reinforcement that those skills are, in fact, the difference, oftentimes the difference makers in leading a life of stability as opposed to continuing to struggle with homelessness, you'll see the psychological turn that's needed as well to remain on top of this problem. The family that we've been working with, I mean, we had a homelessness conference recently involving local city officials, county officials, as well as agency heads and the members of our congregation. This was hosted at our community just a couple of months ago, and the mother and the family that we've been working with came to speak about her experience having learned to drive and having acquired a driver's license. That it was the first time in coming to our synagogue after these couple of years that she had driven herself to come, and she became very emotional talking about it. But what was really clear was it crystallized for her. It was not just a matter of we had demonstrated you're supposed to learn to drive. She understood that this was going to be a freeing mechanism in her life. And you're absolutely right that the psychological and the tangible components really go hand in hand here.
There's another part that I guess goes along with it too, which is, well, let me back up. I have a very good friend who went through a very terrible depression that was, it had lasted a very long time. And one of her family members said, why don't you just come live with me for a while? So she lived with her sister for several years. And she really got a lot better. And she said, you know, it's not just about taking your meds and, you know, having a job. She said it's about waking up every day in a family where you know that in the evening you're going to have barbecue, you're going to go to your bowling league once a week, where you have this stable. It was basically about having an example of what a stable and happy life looks like. And, you know, that comes with contact, and really contact over time.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think it's built into the Imagine LA model, the idea being that there will be a sprinkling of new relationships for a homeless family connected to that church or mosque or synagogue where the help is being provided. Those personal bonds are with families where stability is considered the norm already. And oftentimes, some of the most important things that are acquired and learned in this process may not even be the tangible skill sets. They have to do with understanding, having a picture in one's mind, exactly as you described, of what life will look like, feel like, why it would be worth aspiring to make this shift in life, because the reward in a long-standing kind of way in terms of acquiring stability is going to be there waiting.
All that said, there are also some underlying social and political reasons for homelessness. Do you address those? Do you take them into account? Is that part of the work that you're doing?
That's a great question. The answer is that with regard to the specific project of working with this family, actually, no, that's not a part of that work. The idea here is to find volunteers and to work one family at a time. The real notion, Imagine LA's concept, was that there are 8,000 places of worship in the LA area. There are also believed to be roughly 8,000 homeless families. And the notion is, if you connected up one of the communities, the faith communities, with one of those families, and each one adopted one for the sake of helping to usher them through this transition, you could end family homelessness one family at a time. That's certainly the concept where Imagine LA is concerned. Now, our congregation does get involved in advocacy work as well, exclusive of the work in Imagine LA, to attempt to break down some of the systemic barriers that you're describing. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think there's an important place in congregational work for both, the hands-on work that I think is necessary to sustain your volunteers. Your volunteers want to be able to see some tangible results in the changing of lives. It's what actually feeds the volunteers. By the same token, it goes without saying that our fondest hope would be to transcend the problem, not only to help the families that are presently homeless to find homes and to lead themselves down a more stable path, but also to slowly diminish through systemic change the number of folks who face that predicament. And so, yeah, we definitely take on the advocacy work, whether it has to do with communal agency work, whether it has to do with advocating in state and local government for legislation and change.
How did the homeless families that you work with get involved in the program in the first place?
That's ultimately something that Imagine LA, the parent organization, monitors. There are some standards. They've learned, I think, over the course of these early years in doing this work, how you go about choosing and identifying families that are really ready. They need to be safe. They should ideally be in transitional housing. They already have dealt, if there are severe drug problems, they've dealt with those problems. They have been homeless, and they don't want to be homeless anymore. And so there's a certain readiness to be matched with the faith community. You know, there have been only very, I think that now we're talking about somewhere in the order of 13 to 14 congregations that have done this work. There's been only one failed match so far, and it really has to do with identifying the readiness of the family to move out of transitional housing and to engage and put themselves out there in terms of the emotional vulnerability of saying, okay, I'm ready to make this turn in my life, and I'm ready to accept, reach out for help and accept that help.
How do you match one family with the other, the stable mentor family with the homeless family?
Ultimately, it's matching more of the congregation with the family. Oftentimes, it's not all that specific in terms of trying to figure out which congregation would be best suited to a particular family. It's about finding the family that actually has the demonstration, the demonstrable signs of readiness. And then a congregation, they also need to be cultivated to guarantee that we have the stable of volunteers that will be necessary to do the various tasks. One of the things that we do look for within the congregation is, you know, to make sure that the individuals who will be doing the face-to-face, hand-to-hand contact are folks who can demonstrate some of the things that you were talking about earlier in terms of providing the impetus and the inspiration for reaching out for stability to be able to serve as mentors and exemplars. And really that has to do with the leaders of the task force, the group within the congregation, identifying among their volunteers who are the ones who are best suited for that face-to-face, the person-to-person work.
It's tricky business because on the one hand, you know, you to be a good mentor, you have to have certain personal leadership qualities, but you also, I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, but on some level you really have to know that you're not better than the person that you're helping them, that you're helping. It's just, you know, but for the grace of God, there go I, kind of attitude.
It's a really important point. It is one of the things that we looked for. We're fortunate. Our congregation, while it includes a variety of different kinds of folks from different socioeconomic backgrounds, we certainly have a number of very accomplished folks who are members of our community. They tend to be of a sort. Their interest in our congregation and in the kind of the momentum of the mission of our community, they tend to be self-effacing enough to be able to accomplish this task, because you're absolutely right. The object here is to provide mentoring and guidance without ultimately becoming sort of overly paternal. It's a tricky dance. But ultimately, you're right, the goal is to establish a feeling of peer relationship, while it goes without saying one side of this equation is providing information and life skills and the other is receiving it. So it's a dance. It's one that we have, at least within our own congregation, managed pretty well. My understanding is more broadly the other synagogues and churches that have been involved so far have managed to deal with. But you're absolutely right. It's something that we have to keep our eyes on all the time.
So this is a multi-faith effort. You're a rabbi. You're the rabbi of Leo Beck Temple in Los Angeles. And I was wondering, how does this work draw specifically on Jewish faith and theology?
The churches and synagogues and mosques that get involved in this project tend to be communities that see social justice as an important part of their religious mission. For us, so much of the foundational work of creating the Jewish context for doing this work happens outside of the actual work of the project with this particular family. That is to say, the people who have volunteered are the ones who are coming to worship services where sermons and study is oftentimes built around what are the lessons that we can take from our textual tradition, whether it's Torah or Bible or Talmud or more modern Jewish legal and teaching literature. What are the Jewish foundations for acknowledging our obligation, and not really our desire, but a clear obligation, a human obligation, to lift up those who are fallen and to help to set them on a path that leads to sustenance. It's so fully embedded in the mission of our congregation, whether it's what you would get at services, worship services, whether it's something you'd get in adult or in our child-oriented or family-oriented classes, whether it has to do with the other projects, voluntary projects that we have at the temple. The hope is that that ultimately is brought to this work. We have spent some time doing some study with our volunteers for this particular project. Oftentimes, if we have a meeting of the group, we'll do some study of the textual tradition as the foundation for the discussion that will end up taking place, the more practical conversation that we scheduled the meeting for. It'll have that sort of precursor that brings us back to the very specific Jewish reasons why we go to do this work.
It's funny because it's there in the Jewish tradition, it's there in the Christian and probably any religious tradition, and just as much among atheists who are of that social justice bent. Social justice is almost like a tendency of its own, transcendent of spiritual tradition.
Yeah, I think I'll say this. There are many avenues to arriving there. We certainly, in our synagogue is a progressive Jewish synagogue. We're of the belief that while we have a tremendous sense of zeal and belief in the avenue that we, through Jewish tradition, travel in order to arrive at our social justice values and mission. We're certainly believers that one can arrive there through Christianity, can arrive there through Islam, can arrive there through Eastern religious traditions, and without question can arrive there through moral, ethical imperatives that can be experienced outside of the religious context. I mean, I tend to be a believer myself that the religious sphere ultimately made these values into what we consider to be moral, ethical. I don't know that without the world's religions we automatically arrive at these values, but by the same token, one does not, I think, in the 21st century, automatically have to be inside that dialogue, the religious dialogue, in order to both acquire and ultimately choose to act out those values.
We're talking to Rabbi Ken Chasen of the Leo Beck Temple in Los Angeles. So tell us, I mean, without obviously giving away anybody's confidential details, but tell us some of the stories of the families that you've served so far.
Yeah, well, our synagogue has worked specifically with one family. It is a single mother, as so many of the homeless families are, single mother with a five-year-old when he started with us, son. He's now grown a little older. There's a wealth of family stories, both for that family as well as for our families. I mean, one of the most gratifying things was moving day. I mean, I remember our community, there was just tremendous excitement when it came time. We had finally helped them to identify where their apartment would be. It was located in such a way that they felt that the mother felt that she'd be able to connect to her family, who are located here in town. There was the feeling we had found not just a place, but the right place. And then members of our congregation started volunteering items of their own, furniture, appliances, things that they felt that were lightly used and could easily become an important part of our family's new home. And then there was the family that rented the U-Haul truck, and all of us who got on we delivered all of these items to one of our congregants' homes. They were stored in their garage and beyond, and then bit by bit we started loading up, and there was just an incredible feeling of satisfaction as we had all the volunteers, folks who were assigned to other kinds of tasks but ultimately chose to be involved. They wanted to be involved in that foundational experience of the move, of setting this family up in their own home. And even if they were the ones dealing with checkbooks or dealing with schooling or whatever it may be, they wanted to be a part of that day. And so there was a tremendous, probably more than any other day in this process, the day of moving the family into their home was something that was an incredible galvanizer for our entire community of volunteers.
And does this woman now have a job and something resembling a stable life?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're starting to turn the corner to where we're going to continue a relationship of companionship, friendship, support, but it won't be this sort of preliminary relationship of mentoring that was designed to move from homelessness into the beginning of stability. The answer is, yeah, she has work. She's feeling, I think, much more capable of being able to sustain this change in her and her son's life. And, we feel most grateful for having had the opportunity to carry the work this far.
So do you then take a new person?
Well, that's a good question. You know, our goal, our intention is to do that. In fact, we're trying to see whether or not we may even have the volunteer resources, perhaps, to take on even a second family simultaneously, so we can move to having, a second and a third family. But we are definitely hoping to begin the process anew. I think a lot of our volunteers who were a part of this process the first time through have great enthusiasm about the idea of doing it again. They've seen the results. They know that they were a small part of really helping to change some lives in a very tangible way. While we're also in the process of recruiting new congregations from all the different faith traditions into this project, I mean, it goes without saying our highest goal would be for every community, every faith community here in town, to adopt one family, to do this project, and hopefully we would end the problem once and for all. However, until the time comes, it makes good sense, I think, to go back to churches, synagogues, mosques that have already had success, and for them to re-up. And we're finding that the early congregations in, ours was the first synagogue to participate in the project. There were a couple of churches that were in before us. But the congregations that were among the early participants are now running, the relationship is running its course, and there seems to be great interest in those congregations to start the process anew with a new family.
So there's not only yours, but several other families that have been through this whole process, and the people got on their feet. And so it is it's not just your temple.
Yes, absolutely. No, there's a total heretofore there are 13 families that are connected to 13 faith communities here in Los Angeles. We are at Imagine LA. I serve on the board of Imagine LA, the organization, the parents' organization to the whole project. And we have commitments from congregations that suggest that we're going to be able to grow up to 20 pretty immediately. And our hope is within the next couple of years or so to spread that out to maybe 40 or 50 families. We want to make sure that we grow, but that we don't grow too fast, because we are really committed to doing it well. And as I said, there's really only been one failed match thus far. That's a batting average that we want to sustain.
It's interesting because, I mean, it's a huge problem. Thousands upon thousands of homeless families in Los Angeles. I don't know how many here in Santa Fe, but it's a real problem in every city, every major city, and probably town in the whole United States. And, you know, when you look at the ratio on one congregation, which is, you know, dozens or hundreds of people, to one family, That's a serious ratio. You need so many more people in the congregations than homeless people to make it work, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. I'll say this. I mean, our congregation is fairly large. We're somewhere on the order of nearly 700 families, 650 or so families, let's say. The key is having the community be large enough to where you can generate volunteers who are in for the long haul. We, as I said, have had a number of folks who have been attached to this issue in one way or another episodically over the course of these last couple of years. But fundamentally, the core group that has been working in direct contact with this family, or been working in a sustained way with the family but not in direct personal contact with them, is a group of somewhere around 25 or so. It's not an enormous group. And so a congregation of our size, certainly we felt as though we would be able to find those 25 people. The real challenge was the commitment over the longer period of time. It's not so hard to find people who will volunteer for a special day of service. Finding folks who will volunteer and be willing to be called upon over a course of a couple of years for an ongoing project is a bit more of a challenge. But the synagogues and churches that have been in so far all felt like, as I did, which was, while this was the big fear I had going into it, would we be able to generate those volunteers and keep them interested, that proved to be a much easier task to accomplish than I had imagined in the first place. And my understanding is that my fellow pastors and rabbis and teachers who are leading these projects in their own congregations and communities have felt somewhat similarly.
We're talking to Rabbi Ken Chasen. So how do you work with existing service providers, nonprofits and so on, who are already dealing with homeless people and families?
And this is really what happens more often on the Imagine LA level, on the parent organizations level. That is to say, there are, you're absolutely right, social service organizations, folks who are attached to Section 8 housing, people who know the housing world, both inside government and also in private agencies. The idea is to build bridges for the parent organization to be a connector between all these resources. So often you'll talk to agency heads and they'll tell you, well, we're designed to do this one piece of the puzzle, to provide this one sort of help. The one thing we can't do is provide that ongoing mentoring, that sort of support that transcends the moment in which we deliver the good or service that's needed. And so they're usually quite enthusiastic about throwing in and being a part, at least providing their expertise to Imagine LA, so that when it goes to bring whatever the product is to the synagogue or church that will ultimately be doing the work in a hands-on way with a particular family, they have the benefit of both government agencies and private agencies behind them. There is a feeling of collaboration attached to the project.
So you will be meeting with Santa Feans today at Temple Beth Shalom from 7 to 9 this evening. What are you going to do? The public is invited. What do you hope to happen there?
Well, our hope is to answer some questions about this kind of project. I think the idea of my coming to town had to do with taking this rather unique model. Imagine LA is a fairly new phenomenon, and it's catching on here in Los Angeles, but I think, you know, for us to be able to bring it successfully into other cities. That was the idea of this trip. And so tonight's meeting, I think, will be an opportunity first to answer questions and to share information about the way in which it's been done, and also to allow for conversation between those who are attending the event. Our hope is to begin community conversation around this issue, for people from different faith communities to be able to encounter one another, to talk about their own churches, synagogues, to get a sense, is this something that we thought we could do? Is this something that we believe we could make happen? What might we be able to learn from one another in order to deepen and extend out further the work that we do with the homeless? So that's our main aspiration for tonight.
It's not all that often that different churches and synagogues and mosques and faith communities and stuff really get together and talk to each other, unless I'm wrong. But it seems like it doesn't happen as often as it might. Has that process been easy?
You know, it's been a good part of this work. I think an important part. I mean, we in the clergy, at least in Los Angeles, have done a reasonably good job of being able to find important and common causes to connect one to the other. You're right, the faith communities themselves, you know, it varies from city to city as to whether they have much interface. The truth of the matter is, after a project of this sort is launched, I mean, if in fact something like Imagine LA were to happen here in Santa Fe, the process of launching it and fashioning it and shaping it would itself be very much an interfaith enterprise, and that it would even transcend the faith community, as I said before, into some of these secular agencies, both private and public and governmental. The actual operation of a congregation's relation with a family, once that match is made, it really is it's really not so much an interfaith project on that micro level. It becomes something that volunteers who know each other from within their own faith community are doing collectively to support a homeless family. So there are times where the community once again reconnects, but ultimately it has more to do with creating this apparatus that I think is an interfaith enterprise than actually the operation of it on a family-by-family basis.
And it doesn't require or even encourage particularly that homeless family that's being mentored to become part of the faith community.
Yeah, at least in our model with Imagine LA, it's quite the opposite. The idea is that the family that is participating as a recipient of whatever support we can provide is never, ever pressured to feel as though they should. I mean, as I said before, you know, our family is not Jewish, so they're not looking to be a part of a synagogue. They love the idea that a synagogue, a community of faith, they are faithful people. They love the idea that it is a congregation, a religious community that has reached out to provide this sort of support. And in that regard, you're absolutely right. It is, in fact, an interfaith phenomenon. I mean, here we have a non-Jewish family being served by a Jewish community, what is the common texture, if you will, between all of us is the idea of believing in religious community as a vehicle for furthering one individual family's life, but also in a broader sense, the improvement of the world.
Rabbi Ken Chasen is with the Leo Beck Temple in Los Angeles. And once again, he will be here in Santa Fe at Temple Beth Shalom tonight from 7 to 9, talking about the Imagine LA project to end homelessness in Los Angeles. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been my pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome Jackie M. She's the Director of Education and Public Programs at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. And tomorrow at 5:30, she is giving a talk at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue, a free talk called Everything is Japanese Nowadays, Japonisma and the Birth of Modern Art. Welcome.
Oh, great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
Is that how you say it? Japonisme? Japonism?
Well, it's a French word,
yeah.
So Japonisme.
Japonisme.
But I'm probably saying it with a horrible gringo accent, too. But
not as bad as mine. So what is this? This is a...
Well, let me say, first of all, that this talk is actually part of the Santa Fe Opera Guild's series of talks and presentations that they've been doing all year in this is called a Beyond Opera program. So the reason I'm doing the talk and in collaboration with the museum is because this summer opens the Festival at the Opera. The season opens with Madama Butterfly by Puccini, one of the most beloved operas, as they've been saying on the radio, but also one that really fits into this time period where Europeans and Americans were infatuated and heavily influenced by Japanese culture, Japanese art, and Japanese themes and stories.
And so how did that happen? What happened at that moment where suddenly Europeans got interested in Japan?
Well, although it isn't totally true to say that there was no communication with the West for 200 years, because there were Dutch settlers living on one little island in the near Nagasaki that was actually created where any foreigner could live from about the 1600s, 1620s to 1854, there really had been no trade with European countries and America. And it was the beginning of the Meiji era, which opened its ports, and Commodore Perry arrives in 1854, and in this time period, then goods are starting to come into Europe first, and America, and some of the goods that are transportable and influence, in particular the artists, are the Japanese prints. So Europeans actually had seen some prints prior to that time, but for the most part, because there was not an exchange, there really was an embargo on that exchange. As I said, only there were a few Dutch merchants that were able to have the exchange. It was like an explosion of ideas. To put myself in the time period, I have to think about how saturated we are by images these days. Anywhere we turn, from publications to television, our internet, etc. But at that time, you know, to see these strikingly beautiful prints, where you didn't have that much visual, you had a visual world around you, but you had sort of dark Renaissance-oriented kinds of drawings. The difference was dramatic, and the influence on artists also very exciting.
And the aesthetic was so different, because not only did you have these dark, as you say, oil paintings and things like that, but also so much Renaissance perspective, and these are a very flat, totally different look, I would imagine, to people looking at them for the first time.
Yes, exactly. The movement from one-point perspective to multiple points of view, the kind of cropping that we're going to see later that a camera will do, but in fact, the Japanese would crop the images oddly and show you multiple scenes at one time. They also, the ornamentation, the fabrics in the kimono, the colors that were used, and the woodblock print colorfulness of those prints, the stories that were told, and also the imagery itself, because you know, the Yukioi prints investigated the nightlife, the courtesan, and there were also Shunga prints, which are quite erotic prints. So depending on the artist, the influences are different in what they pick up and what they will utilize. Like, I brought you a picture right here.
Ah, yes, I'm holding it up to the microphone, ladies and gentlemen. It's a cross-eyed, looks like a photograph of a cross-eyed man sitting in a very elaborate kimono, cross-legged, with his eyes crossed.
And that is Toulouse-Lautrec, the famous...
That's Toulouse-Lautrec.
Yes.
I wish I could put this on my website. Anyway.
Well, I brought it because I think for us, it reads rather humorous, but it's actually a portrait where he imagines himself to be imitating one of the grimaces that would have been popular in Kabuki theater. And of course, Lautrec, over some of the other impressionists, post-impressionists, was very interested in kind of the nightlife, Montmartre. And so he takes that influence from Hokusai's drawings into his work and dramatically portrays it with the posters that he did of those performers like Jean Avril, and also a number of his paintings. And here he kind of embodies it himself. He said that he really liked the Japanese because they were small like him. So, but he's only one of many artists that were influenced. Van Gogh was so influenced that in letters to his brother Theo, he says, you know, everything now in my art is Japanese. And although maybe many people have seen his work and loved it without realizing that,
yeah,
when you start to look comparatively at what he's looking at and how he's taking it, you can actually see the strength of this influence.
And of course, when one culture appropriates another, whether or not there are kind of economic imperialist connotations to the whole thing, the fact is that they saw the surface of it, but it's impossible to know the depth and meaning and metaphors inside of an art of a completely foreign culture when it just hits you suddenly.
That, I think, is part of the fascination when we don't put a sort of political correctness onto this appropriation, which, of course, at the time was all done out of with great enthusiasm. These right. prints hit. There were dealers in Paris. There were publications. There were cafes people would go to see the prints and show the prints or show their drawings next to prints. And you know what? There was also a cultural exchange that took place with the coming of the West and the depiction of Westerners in Japanese prints. That's not so much called Japanisme, but I think we shouldn't miss the fact that we're talking about an exchange.
It goes both ways.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes the contrast is rather fascinating and interesting to see how they depict the Westerner within what we would call a more typical woodblock print scene. Here's an example from, these are actually considered to be Dutch persons who, as I said, the Dutch ports stayed open. There was an island called Deshima that was created. It really was just a leveled rock or a little mountain or mound in near Nagasaki, and they didn't have access to the mainland. So the only people who could really come over and service or be part of their culture that were Japanese were actually the courtesans who would come. And there are stories that go back in terms of these relationships, which very much fit into the story of Chuchu-san and Madama Butterfly. It's kind of taken from that. So it's not only the visual arts. Certainly a number of the stories of the Japanese lifestyle influences modern writers and fascinates them. But my talk is really going to focus on what was happening in the visual arts at the time that really is a hallmark of the change into what we would call modern painting and modern art.
And all of this with images can be experienced by you, dear listener, tomorrow, Tuesday, the 4th of May at 5:30 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex in Santa Fe at 123 Grant Avenue. It's free to Georgia O'Keeffe Museum members. There's a charge for the general public. Jackie M. is Director of Education and Public Programs at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum.
And also free to any members of the guilds of the Santa Fe Opera.
That's right, the Santa Fe Opera Guilds as well. Jackie, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome Catherine Geyer. She's a student at the University of New Mexico, and she's doing a project to raise awareness about hunger among senior citizens in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, this is a very serious problem that a lot of people don't know about. How did you start working on this project?
Well, it was part of a project that I'm doing for my a class I'm taking at UNM, and it resulted from my grandfather moving in with my family and reading a book about senior hunger in America. And I really got connected with this issue, and I really wanted to go out and tell people about senior hunger, because for myself, I didn't know how serious of an issue it was, and I thought that there was other people out there who didn't know either, and I knew that awareness is the first step towards causing change.
So tell us about the situation. Obviously, people are living on Social Security payments that are not very big.
Yeah, that is a big problem, and frankly, sometimes Social Security prevents them from getting other aid, because in order to get, you know, food stamps, for example, you need to prove that you don't make a certain income, and the Social Security sometimes shows that they are making such and such income, but it doesn't account for that they're having to pay for medical costs as well, and rent costs, and all those different sorts of things, and there's no money left for food.
In theory, their health costs are covered by Medicare.
Yeah.
But in reality?
Well, I think there's a lot of extra costs that aren't covered by Medicare. And in addition, there's so many other costs for seniors, like rent and utilities and transportation, especially in Santa Fe, transportation is a big issue. Although in the city, they get free transportation throughout town. If they live in the county, they don't get free transportation. So a senior who might have enough money to buy food at the grocery store doesn't have enough money to buy food and pay for transportation. So all these other costs can compound and cause a big issue.
What kind of services, food services, are available for seniors who don't have enough to eat?
Well, in Santa Fe City, there's Meals on Wheels, and that's a really great thing for seniors who are homebound. But the seniors who aren't, certifiably homebound by a doctor, they don't qualify to receive Meals on Wheels. But they can go to the senior centers and get free meals there. They can also go to food banks like Food Depot and places like that.
So you have been doing a project at UNM, which is almost over now. Graduation is in about a week, but
yeah.
You've been doing a project to raise awareness. What have you been doing?
Well, what I did is I called a bunch of organizations here in Santa Fe and tried to get 10 or so minutes to talk to the groups. Like I talked to the Rotary Club, the Lions Club. I talked over at Temple Beth Shalom and a couple of Boy Scout troops let me come in and talk to them. And what I really, my focus and my intention of the project was really just to get out and make people aware of what was happening in New Mexico right now with respect to senior hunger. And I asked people to sign pledge cards that was a sort of promise to do something. And in my presentations, I said, I really don't care if you decide to donate money or just to tell a friend, because I really came from the perspective that awareness is the best thing right now for us to do, because I think awareness has two main outcomes. The first is that it can reach more people, and more people will then donate money, donate time, become involved in this issue. And the second is that it might reach a senior who didn't know that there was these programs available. And also, a major issue for seniors is the emotional effect of being hungry. A lot of seniors feel guilty and ashamed that they don't have the resources available to buy themselves food. And a lot of them worry that by utilizing food services, they're taking away from younger generations. And I thought that my awareness programs would educate both people in the community and seniors that there are these programs available, and it's not something that's taking away from younger generations, that there's enough food and there's enough resources. The problem is really leadership and getting people involved in this issue, and that's why I wanted to give these awareness talks.
It really does highlight the horrible problem of inequality in our community, in our country, and of all the problems we talk about, inequality, for some reason, doesn't get a whole lot of airtime.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think for myself, I definitely, before taking on this issue, I really didn't have any idea how many seniors in New Mexico were suffering, and the numbers that I've been able to find from the Food Depot says that there's 21,000 people over 65 who are using food banks, and
in the state of New Mexico?
Yes. And in addition, in my research throughout America, I don't know specifically about New Mexico in this respect, but I know that the most at-risk group is from 60 to 65, so that number of 21,000 might not be the most accurate number of how many seniors are really suffering in New Mexico.
Isn't that interesting, the most at-risk group between 60 and 65?
Yeah, I was really astonished by that, too. I thought that it was much older people would be affected more. And through the research that I did, I found that traditionally the Meals on Wheels program, which is specifically directed to elders, they had focused on bringing aid to seniors who are older because they also thought that was the group that was most at risk. And I guess by not paying attention to this, or maybe not paying attention, but not paying enough attention to this 60 to 65 group, there was a growing need there that just didn't get filled. And I think it's also because seniors who are 60 to 65 might be just at the point of retiring, and some seniors, a major reason why they get into these severe situations is because they get injured or hurt before they can collect retirement benefits, and that's a really big issue, so that's maybe why that age group is affected a little more.
If people want to devote some time and attention to this issue and get involved, what should they do?
Well, there's a lot of organizations here in Santa Fe who are fighting this issue. The Food Depot is definitely one. Food for Santa Fe. They give out bags of food on Wednesdays, and they're a big help to the community. Also, Faith at Work is a major organization, and they actually they help seniors fill out forms and help qualify for services, because one of the major issues with seniors and hunger is access issues. You know, unlike able-bodied people, they might not be able to move around as easily. They might have vision difficulties. They might have hearing difficulties where they feel isolated from their surroundings. And that prevents them from accessing the services that might be available to them. So in addressing senior hunger, I think Faith at Work does a really nice job, because they help bridge that access issue.
Catherine Geyer is a student at the University of New Mexico, and she has been raising awareness about hunger among senior citizens in Santa Fe. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.